Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. A warm welcome to all of you. Thank you very much for joining us this afternoon for our event, which is titled Zooming In on Middle East and Africa, Action for Climate and Security. My name is Christoph Heusgen, and I'm the chairman of the Munich Security Conference, and I'm very happy and delighted to co-host this event together with the German Federal Foreign Office and with NATO. Some housekeeping at the very beginning. We will start this panel or this discussion with Jens Stoltenberg, the NATO Secretary General, who will join us from Brussels. He will be with us for about 30 minutes. And within, we have a few questions, and then it's opened up for questions also from you, from the audience. There is a microphone where you can step. After half an hour, we will then turn over to the panel, and the panelists will come up here. But I already see on screen the NATO Secretary General. Jens, wonderful to have you. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for inviting me to this event, and many thanks to the Munich Security Conference, to the Federal Minister of Foreign Affairs of Germany for co-hosting the event, and to you, Ambassador Heusgen, Christoph, because for me it is an honor to be part of a COP again. As the first ever Secretary General of NATO, I participated at the Conference of the Parties, the COP in Glasgow last year. And even though it's only virtual, it's great to be back at the COP this time. My understanding is that your question was about whether we are, or to what extent we're able to follow up what we agreed in the NATO strategic concept that was agreed at the NATO summit in June this year, where we actually make climate change an issue for NATO for the first time. We have to realize that in the strategic concept that was valid until we updated or made a new one in June, climate change is not mentioned. We have realized over the last couple of years that climate change, of course, is something that NATO has to address. And there are, in a way, three things that NATO has to do. One is to fully understand the link between climate change and security. Climate change impacts security. Climate change is a crisis multiplier. It increases competition over scarce resources, water, food, land. It forces millions of people to flee. So climate change creates conflicts, exacerbates conflicts. And since climate change matters for security, climate change matters for NATO. And we need to fully understand that link, because we need to understand the different threats we are faced with. So we are building up our capacity when it comes to analyze, understand, assess the link between climate change, wars, conflict, and security. The second thing which matters for NATO is that, of course, climate change, more extreme weather, windier, wilder, wetter weather, matters for military operations. We have a training mission in Iraq, and they have experienced more than 50 degrees Celsius. Our equipment, our uniforms have to adapt to more extreme weather. We have the melting of the ice in the Arctic. It matters for the strategic importance of the Arctic. Increased sea levels matters for all our naval bases. So we just have to adapt our operations, our missions, our equipment, our uniforms to climate change, to more extreme weather. And we are in the process of doing that by incorporating climate change in our military planning, our capability targets, and everything we do. And thirdly, of course, our armed forces have to be part of the efforts to reduce emissions. And if you look at, what should I say, traditional military equipment, heavy battle tanks, battleships, planes, they are not normally very green. They emit a lot. So we need to find a way to reduce military emissions. I attended my first COP in 1997 in Kyoto. And there I remember that military missions was explicitly exempted from reporting on a mission from different countries. So they were exempted from the whole equation. Now military missions are part of what is counted, but the data is not good. So we are now we have launched a project in NATO to standardize how we report on emissions from military operations, because that's the first step towards reducing military emissions. And I strongly believe that in the future we need green, but also, of course, effective military capabilities. But in the future, the most effective military capabilities will be the green and environmentally friendly ones. So that's the three things we need to do and are doing in NATO: understand the link between climate change and security, adapt our military missions and operations to more extreme weather, and thirdly, reduce military emissions, starting by mapping military missions in a much, much better way than we do today.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much for this. I think that's very important that NATO, so to speak, from 97 to today has been mainstreaming in the efforts to see how we can reduce climate change. And I think it's very important that that comes also from Brussels to all NATO members. Now, Secretary General, you spend time on this issue, but you spend most of the time now on Russia's aggression against Ukraine. What are, again, in the context of what we have been discussing from your perspective, what are the global implications of Russia's war against Ukraine, in particular for food and energy security? How does it impact the fight against climate change and the path to net zero?
Well, the war in Ukraine is a brutal war of aggression launched by President Putin against the independent, sovereign, democratic nation. It's a blatant violation of territorial integrity and sovereignty of Ukraine. And it causes bloodshed, suffering, death, killing of civilians every day in Ukraine. Therefore, the war has to end because it causes so much suffering for Ukrainians. But on top of that, the war in Ukraine has global ramifications. It has triggered a global food crisis, a spike in food prices, and a global energy crisis. Because we have to understand that it's not the sanctions imposed by the European Union, by NATO allies, by the United States, that has caused a spike in energy and food prices. That is the war. It is the fact that because there are no sanctions against food, no sanctions against the export of grain from Ukraine. So what has caused this food and energy crisis is the war itself. And that's a deliberate war by President Putin. He has deliberately weaponized energy, food, in his attempt to take control over Ukraine. And it has caused a lot of damage for the most vulnerable people in the world, because they have to pay a higher price for energy and a higher price for food because of the war. Then I'm glad that we have the United Nations, Turkey, a NATO ally, and the international community has been able to negotiate, to agree the grain deal that has enabled export of grain out of Ukraine to at least partly reduce the pressure in the global food market. I just visited this weekend Istanbul. I actually saw the grain ships sailing to the Bosporus Strait. I spoke with President Erdogan, and of course I also praised him for the efforts of Turkey to facilitate the grain deal. And we continue to call on Russia to respect the grain deal and also to be willing to extend the grain deal, because the war is catastrophic for the people of Ukraine who suffer every day. But the war in Ukraine also has global ramifications, caused not by the sanctions, but by the war. The best way of addressing this is for President Putin to end the war, to stop fighting and to respect Ukraine. Then we will see more food exports, we will see more energy exports, and that will be the best way to also alleviate or to address the global ramifications of the war.
This is, of course, a topic that is also being discussed here in Sharm el-Sheikh. What is your prediction? How long will this war last?
Wars are by nature unpredictable, and therefore I will be very careful about predicting how long it will last. But I strongly believe that NATO allies, partners around the globe, we must continue to provide support to Ukraine. Because if President Putin wins, Russia wins in Ukraine, that will send a message to President Putin, but also to other authoritarian leaders, that they can get their way, that they can achieve their goals by using brutal military force. Of course, as most wars, this war will at some stage most likely end at the negotiating table. But we know that what happens around the negotiating table is fundamentally linked to the situation on the battlefield. And the only way for Ukraine to achieve a result around in those negotiations that will most likely happen on some stage, which is acceptable for them and which ensures that Ukraine can prevail as a sovereign independent nation, is that they have the strength of the battlefield that enables an acceptable outcome on the negotiating table. So we need to support Ukraine to strengthen their hand in what most likely at some stage will become negotiations to end the war. The last thing I will say is that we have to remember what this is. This is a war of aggression. One country, Russia, attacking another country. So if President Putin and Russia stops to fight, then we will have peace. If President Zelensky and Ukraine stops to fight, then Ukraine will cease to exist as an independent nation. So this is the difference between an aggressor and the victim of aggression. We support Ukraine in the right for self-defense, a right actually enshrined in the UN Charter. So President Putin must stop the war. That will be good for Ukraine, it will be good for our security, and it will be good for global food and energy prices, and that makes it just even more important for him to stop the war.
Well, thank you very much for this important statement, and let me dwell on it one more time. When you talk to people in Africa, Latin America, Asia, that really are suffering now from what you have mentioned about the rise in energy price and food prices, they say, well, this war has to come to an end. Can't there be a ceasefire? Can't there be now negotiations and put pressure on both sides to stop the war? And you have just been explaining what that would mean for Ukraine, but I get the feeling that many people in the Global South just say, well, when we have conflicts, of course, we get pressure to have a ceasefire to stop. And here now we are saying, no, this has to go on. I think we have to do a lot of explaining there. And I would like to give you this opportunity again, why it is not a simple solution that you just say, OK, now we stop and have a ceasefire.
Because if Ukraine gives into the Russian demands and accept that Russia can just move in, invade Ukraine and then take territory, then there is a risk that will not only encourage them to attack again and again, and then they achieve more and more after every invasion. We have to remember that this war didn't start in February 2022. It started in 2014. When Russia illegally annexed Crimea and took control over the eastern part of Ukraine. And now they attack again and launch a full-scale invasion in February. And if then Russia once again sees that the use of brutal force is actually the way to achieve what they want, then that's a catastrophe for Ukraine, but it's also dangerous for all of us. Because it then sends the message that the use of brutal force is the way to achieve political goal to take control over a neighboring country. And we also have to remember that at the start of the war, Russia stated ambitions not only regarding Ukraine, but also regarding NATO and NATO allies. They wanted NATO to close its door to prevent Finland and Sweden from becoming NATO members, as they now have applied to and actually been invited to become. They wanted NATO to remove all its forces from the eastern part of the alliance to introduce some kind of second-class membership of this alliance. And of course, that's not acceptable. So the main problem is that Russia wants to re-establish a system of sphere of influence where they can decide what neighbors can do or not do. And that is a more dangerous world. And that's the reason why it's enshrined in the UN Charter that every country has a right to self-defense. Ukraine is defending themselves. NATO and NATO allies are not party to the conflict, but we support Ukraine in upholding the UN enshrined right for self-defense. That is what we are doing. And again, as I said, everyone wants this war to end, but if Ukraine stops to fight, they will cease to exist as an independent nation. If Russia stops to fight, then we will have peace. Then we have to remember that the global ramifications, they are caused by the fact that Russia blocked ports, Ukrainian ports for many months. They stole grain, they stole ships, and they have made it very hard to export critical commodities. This has caused the global ramifications, the global consequences on for food and energy prices, which matters then for the global south. So yes, we should end the war, and the best and easiest way to do that is for President Putin to respect the sovereignty of a neighbor, Ukraine.
Thank you. Thank you very much for this explanation. Now, we have about 8 more minutes, and this is a chance for you to ask a question, to ask the Secretary General of NATO a question. Who is ready to do that? We have the microphone right here in the middle.
Mr. Secretary, Mr. Ambassador, my name is Karim Amin. I work for Siemens Energy. And of course, my question goes into the energy security and the security topic, you know, of Europe and the aggression and the war you talked about became, you know, two sides of one coin. So perhaps you could put some perspective of how does this impact the energy security as well going forward, and what would be the key priorities of the NATO to address this topic as well. Thank you.
Well, I strongly believe that what we have seen in Ukraine and Russia's attempts or the use of energy as a weapon against NATO allies and other countries is a stark reminder of the need to transition from dependence on fossil fuels to renewables. Because that will make us less dependent on Russian gas, on Russian oil. And that's exactly also why I strongly believe that actually the more we can be able to help NATO allies and countries all around the world to go from fossil fuels to renewables, that will be good for our security, but it will also be good for climate change or our efforts to mitigate climate change. So the good news is that there is a kind of common interest, both our security interest, but also our interest in fighting global warming, climate change, to be less dependent on fossil fuels, especially from Russia. And that's exactly what we are addressing in NATO, how to help to facilitate, support that transition.
Thank you very much. There is a second question.
Thank you very much, Secretary General, for speaking today. Last year, NATO released its climate action plan.
Could you introduce yourself?
Oh, I'm Tamara with the Canadian delegation. I was wondering if you could speak more about the specific targets that NATO has. It released its climate action plan last year. I'm wondering if you can specify what the targets are for 2030. I'm also wondering if NATO is tracking the climate and environmental impacts of the weapons being sent to Ukraine. And finally, on climate financing, NATO members have increased their military spending to approximately $1.2 trillion. It's over $200 billion annually, but we are struggling to find money for climate financing, for loss and damage, for adaptation. I'm wondering about the possibility of reducing military spending and in investing in developing countries and in their climate challenges. Thanks.
First, on defense spending, I fully understand that it is hard for NATO allies to meet the NATO guidelines of spending more on defense, 2% of GDP. And I was Minister of Finance, I was also Minister of Prime Minister of Norway for 10 years. And at least in the beginning of that period, we, as most other NATO allies, or actually all other NATO allies, we reduced defense spending because tensions went down and we believed in a more peaceful and secure world after the end of the Cold War. But then the brutal reality is that we live now in a more dangerous world. We live now in a world where we see, especially Russia, using brutal military force against neighbors. We saw it in Georgia in 2008. They have forces in Moldova without the consent of the government in Moldova. Then they used military force against Ukraine in 2014, and now again full-fledged invasion in this winter. So all of that has just regrettably made the world more dangerous. And when we reduce defense spending when tensions are going down, we need to increase defense spending when tensions are going up. I regret that because I fully understand that there are many other aims or purposes that politicians would like to spend money on, like climate change, support for developing countries, education, and many other purposes. But if we don't have peace, if we don't have security, then we'll fail with all the other tasks that lies ahead of us. So a precondition to be able to address climate change is that we preserve peace. And that's the reason why we also need to invest, because we have seen, for instance, that the only way to support Ukraine is actually also to provide them with military support. We are now what we have done so far is to dig into our own stocks of ammunition and weapons, but then we need to, of course, replenish those stocks. That has a price tag, and therefore I regret to say that there is a need to invest more in defense. Again, if we saw a less aggressive Russia, then the need would have been not so big to invest so much in defense as we now have to do. Without peace, we'll not be able to address development issues or climate change issues. Let me also just, since you were from Canada, congratulate Canada and commend Canada for now establishing a center of excellence on climate change that will actually enhance our understanding, the way we work together as allies in addressing the security consequences of climate change. The concrete target we have agreed is to cut emissions from NATO bodies and commands by at least 45% by 2030 and move towards net zero by 2050. We have to do this in many different ways. Some have expressed some skepticism that can we have effective green battle tanks? And I strongly believe that in the future, the most effective military capabilities will be environmentally friendly. I don't think that NATO can remain a kind of fossil fuel alliance in a world of renewables. When you see the civilian sector developing more and more advanced modern engines, electric cars, electric vehicles, which are green and effective, I'm absolutely certain that in the future there will be no contradiction between green and effective. The most effective military capabilities will also be green, and NATO has to be part of that technological revolution. And that's also the reason why we are investing in technology as part of our climate adaptation.
Thank you very much. A last very short question.
Thank you, moderator. Thank you, General Secretary. My name is Cornelia Föbo-Gwatzi from Berlin. Here I'm representing the ACT Alliance, a faith-based organization of more than 150 churches and church-based organizations in humanitarian aid and development, and I'm its climate justice ambassador. Since quite some time, the human security or people security has been very high on the agenda of the UN and formed a very important aspect of its concept. And already in 2008 or something, climate change was made a very important part of the concept of human security, people's security. I'm wondering, I'd like to ask you whether and how high people's security as part of the or in linked with climate security, with climate change, as part of your strategy when you try to address climate change in all your operations and in all your missions. So what role would then play the concept of people security? Thank you.
So climate change affects human security, people security every day. We see that with the droughts, with the flooding, the extreme consequences that is caused by climate change. And that's the top of the agenda in the discussions in Sharm el-Sheikh, as we all can read, even those who are not attending the conference as I, we of course we read reports and we see that this is the main topic of the conference, and that's also the reason why I think that the meeting in Sharm el-Sheikh is so important. What matters for NATO is of course the link between climate change and security, and as I just stressed, is that climate change is a crisis multiplier. It affects our security, and therefore it matters for NATO. Human security is violated every day when there is war. And therefore we see now in Europe that human security is violated every day in Ukraine. And the best way to prevent that is to preserve peace. And NATO's core and main task is to prevent war, preserve peace. Our task is not to provoke a conflict, but it's actually prevent the conflict. And we do that by standing together, protecting each other. And for more than 70 years, that has preserved peace in Europe for those allies, for those countries who are NATO allies. Then Ukraine is not a NATO ally, but Ukraine is a close partner. And therefore, we support Ukraine in their efforts to defend themselves, to protect human security, and to stop the meaningless suffering, bloodshed that is caused by the war of aggression launched by President Putin.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Secretary General. Thank you very much for spending time with us. Sorry for the technical problems at the very beginning. We hope to see you mid-February at the Munich Security Conference, this time in person. Again, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much.